Welcome to Changing the Course, Building an Anti-Racist Education. My name is Nicholas Jones, Assistant Director of Student Support and Culture here at Noble Schools. We're excited today to be kicking off Season 2, Episode 1 of Changing the Course, Staying the Course. And today we have the opportunity to speak with Jennifer Reed Davis and Dee Nigel Green of Noble's Equity Team. Today we talk about their DEI work, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion work, where it is and where it's going here at Noble. Let's jump in. All right, today I'm here with Jennifer Reed Davis and Dee Nigel Green. And before we jump into our conversation, we'd like for you both to introduce yourselves to our audience. Jennifer, would you mind going first?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I am Jennifer Reed Davis, the Head of Strategy and Equity for Noble Schools.
I'm Dee Nigel Green, the Director of Equity, Inclusion, and Diversity for Noble.
All right. So once one, I want to thank you all for joining Changing the Course. This is our Season 2 that we're opening up with you two. And so we want to make sure our audience has a good idea of who you are, your role at Noble, and kind of talk through your why behind Noble and why behind DEI.
Okay. Why Noble? I think, I'm in year 12, 13, one of them, for working at Noble. And I think my why today is really about our staff and student experience, and understanding the kind of model that I believe Noble can be for our city, for our country, for other schools and other charter schools, about how we can really truly run schools that are centered in DEI and anti-racism. I think it's possible. We're not there yet, but I do believe that Noble has the potential to be a model for that. And so I would say that's my why today. And then I'm a mommy of a little, very precocious and gorgeous 2-year-old girl, 2-year-old daughter. And she doesn't change my why, but she definitely makes it more urgent because I see how quickly time moves. And I want to do my part in making sure that her options include great schools that I believe will honor the brilliance of my Black daughter, and also prepare her for college. And so I want to build that and help build that for other parents.
Nice.
I think my why is not too dissimilar from Jennifer's. This is year 13 for me. 10 of those were spent at a campus. And like coming into Noble, I saw myself and my kids every day. Mm-hmm. But also being an adult, I saw what my kids might potentially face outside of this space. And like it was really important for me to be able to transition to use my skills to impact the work that we do in a way that not only prepared my children for what the world might be, but also preparing my children to change the world that awaits them. And that was really important for me. And the best way that I could do that is in doing this work and supporting the brilliant leaders and adults that kind of honor our children by serving them, to do that in a way that is equitable and just.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked about Noble being a model for anti-racist education, for DEI work in education. What does that model currently consist of, and how do we start that process with just being and committed to being anti-racist and committed to DEI work at Noble?
Yeah, that's a good question. So maybe around 2017, I would say. Actually, I think it was 2017. So about June of 2017, I spent some time with a mentor of mine who used to, at that time, work for Teach for America. And I was going to meet with her just for some advice about the way in which Noble can go about scaling our DEI work across our network. And at that time, we were really focused on our core values of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and naming it as a priority for the organization. And one of the things that my mentor said to me, I didn't even know how important it was, but I would argue it's the first step of any model. And that is that the CEO, whoever's at the tippity-tippity top of the organization, has to be 100% committed to it and willing to do what it takes. And so much to where that person needs to also be able to speak power to DEI being center and mattering at that organization or at that school. And if the CEO was unable or unwilling to do that, then your organization isn't ready. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, I don't think it all hinges on that one person, you know. And at that time, our CEO was. I spent a lot of time, you know, helping to craft that message, particularly for that school year. But I learned just how important it is that your leaders really, really, really are committed to doing it, to doing the work, and to doing what it takes. And that's probably first, because what it takes is the hard part.
Right.
But if they're not committed to it and not willing to speak to it at any given time and in an even given place, you can have all the other steps of the model that you want. It's going to fall apart because, you know, whatever our leaders say is important becomes important. Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that's the first step of any model, is like that level of just like deep, true, genuine commitment from the top. I would say, I don't know if it's next, but I would say another part of a model would definitely be the elevation and the inclusion of the right voices to determine the roadmap for the organization. Mm-hmm. I think so often, you know, we make a statement or a proclamation that we want to be committed to justice. We want to be committed to DEI in our schools, which is great. It's important. And then we have one singular person then tell us how to do that. And that is, in my opinion, in opposition of the true spirit of what it means to center DEI, because I don't have all the answers. I do not represent diverse perspectives. I have my perspective, I have my experience. I bring all of me to the table, but I do not represent Noble in any kind of stretch of the imagination. We serve 12,000 kids. We have 1,500 adults who work for us. And so how do you then create a space where you are inviting people to the table to then determine what does DEI mean for this organization? Mm-hmm. Because it means different things for different people. Mm-hmm. D and I are extremely proud Chicagoans. We represent the Windy City with lots of fervor and passion. Mm-hmm. But I say that to say, like, what it means to run an anti-racist school or to build a school that truly is centered on DEI looks very different in Chicago than what it looks like in San Francisco, than what it looks like in Oakland or Indianapolis, mm-hmm. because your city is a huge, important context. Mm-hmm. So I think like there's a couple of steps that I would say are part of the model, but if I had to like name how to start, I would say first, it has to start with your leader. And then second, it has to start with your people. Mm-hmm. Anything after that, if we put anything before the people, I would argue that it really isn't then about the people. They weren't at the table to help create it.
Mm-hmm. So an organization as large as Noble, who touches 12,000 kids, add their families to that number, but
right.
also a lot of our schools sit in different communities across the Chicagoland area.
Right.
What was our process in getting those different stakeholders and those different people in a space where we can start crafting that roadmap to anti-racist education at Noble, anti-racism at Noble?
Well, it begins by inviting them. Like, it begins by like acknowledging like who is and who is not in the space. And then creating forums and pathways for folks to like have access to those spaces. And so for Noble, which was one of the things that Jennifer and I like first, you know, began these new roles with doing, is like, all right, how do we get to our people? Mm-hmm. And how do we invite them into the spaces where they may not typically be as involved? And so we worked with, in large part, with our college team to speak to our alumni. Mm-hmm. We worked in large part with our public affairs team to speak to our families. We worked with, you know, our academics team to speak to our teachers, right? You know, and so there was a large process to bring folks in and create space for folks. And if you have time, would you please mm-hmm. be willing? And, you know, like all of those things. And what we found is, like, oddly enough, people were willing to dedicate their time and energy to those spaces to give voice because they care just as much about this work as we do. Mm-hmm. It's just that they hadn't had the form and the pathway to get as involved as needed. Mm-hmm. And now they do. And we're very proud of that.
Yeah. And what were the avenues? So you talk like, you know, in Chicago, you know, there are barriers, one being transportation. A lot of times, like, can you come to a place? It's not always possible to do that. Time and doing the day work scheduling, whether I work from 7 to 3 or 3 to 11 mm-hmm. overnight shift, what avenues do we use to ensure that like all families or all stakeholders had an opportunity to provide their opinion around like what this roadmap looked like for Noble?
I mean, I don't know whether it's for better or for worse, but it's the facts. We did a lot of that process during the pandemic while mm-hmm. we were still remote at Noble. And so I think it has pros and cons, but at the time we had to do what we had to do with mm-hmm. what we had. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about late 2020, early 2021. And so we did it all virtually, which like I always wonder if our product would be different if we had did it in person. Mm-hmm. But I think we were actually able to cast a wider net because the barrier wasn't time, location, transportation. Like I can recall being on calls myself while cooking dinner and or nursing my daughter. And I can recall calls where watching other stakeholders doing the same exact same thing.
And it was obviously right? normal. It's all good.
And it was mm-hmm. it was normal because it was what it was, right? Like I can recall a parent that I know who like works for CTA, so for the Chicago Transit Authority, right? And I remember seeing her like in her uniform on her lunch break, logged on to our call about our dress code mm-hmm. and how we had to do those meetings in person, she would have missed it because she was at work. So I remember that. And I mean, we didn't know anything different. At that point, it was the middle of the pandemic. Noble was still at that time, I think almost all remote. We weren't in person at all. But we had to get the work done. And to Dee's point, like all of our stakeholders were really invested in being able to be a part of the work. So whether we had working groups that were solely focused on teaching and learning, whether we had working groups that were solely focused on our student uniform or our policies around student experience at Noble, or whether they were just to give feedback on all the things that we brought to them about what we were trying to create and redo, you know, the access of being able to do it virtually, like if I had to do it over again, I think I probably still would mm-hmm. because it allowed us, you know, just to get to a wider net of people that I don't know we would have gotten to beforehand. It also allowed us to create another mechanism of being able to gather feedback from not just our teachers. Like, we had systems in place about how we gather feedback and input from teachers via surveys or other methods of communication with them. But we didn't have that infrastructure built when it came to our alumni or our students or our parents. And I would argue that, I mean, next to our teachers, what our students have to say and parents have to say is, you know, like of the utmost importance. And though our changes did not impact our alumni in lots of ways, Dee always says this, right? But our alumni are actually the experts of the Noble experience because they're the only people that have gone through it all the way, right? And so
they've been able to go through it and reflect and look
back. Right? And so they have wisdom and lessons for us that no other stakeholder has. Hard stop. And so it allowed us to be able to then create the infrastructures to be able to gather feedback in mass in a way that I think if we had not been remote, if the world had not been on pause and the way in which it was, I think we probably would have had more hurdles. And this took us forever. Like, I don't want to make this sound romantic.
How long was the process? Give all these ideas around. Like,
yeah.
You mentioned the pandemic. We know that was, you know, 2020, but it's 2017 to 2020.
I mean, I think it's one of the parts that we miss about what it really means to build inclusive schools or anti-racist schools, is that oftentimes our processes look very different than they do when DEI is not important to you. But when it is important to you, the way in which you go about making a decision has to look different. I say this often. I'm going to say it again today. And that is that our processes are also the products. It is not just about the end goal. It is also about how you get there and who got to say what along the way. Who did you invite to the table? And then when they got to the table, who did you prepare? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to invite parents to our table. It's something that we learned. I would argue maybe the hard way, right? But like we would invite parents to the conversation, but we didn't properly prepare them. So here we are using all the noble lingo, all the acronyms, you know, that we could throw out. But if you don't properly equip people to be a part of the conversation, then it's still not inclusive. You're just doing the dance, right? It's like inviting people to the party and you didn't tell them the dress code.
Right.
So yeah, I'm here and I'm invited, but I may feel there's another level of like awkwardness. You know, we've all been to an event where you were the one who was underdressed because you didn't get the memo. And that's not real inclusion. And so I think it takes longer. For us, it took, I mean, our CEO made the commitment of anti-racism for Noble in June of 2020. We published what anti-racism at Noble means in January of 2021. And then we finalized our processes and our policies in June of 2021. So if we had to go from the time that our CEO said this is who we're going to become, largely in response to George Floyd's murder and the change in our country, to us deciding what that meant, that was 6 months. And then once we decided what that meant and then making necessary changes to our policies was another 6 months. But if your stakeholders are important to you, it's worth the time.
So in that time, we arrived at, we go through our process, we come with a product. And then we had a chance last year to kind of see products kind of go into action, go into practice. Where are we now? Doing season two, episode one, Changing the Course, Anti-Racist Education. What's our anti-racist commitment and our progress now in Noble?
Great. So I think in terms of where we are now after that process, and I would hesitate to say like completion.
But like, it's not completion.
Well, see, I ask, like, be honest with the audience so the audience understands, right? It's not about, you know, having this beautiful thing that's on the website or that we promote to parents, but it's something that we are constantly reflecting on and adjusting and refining. Yeah. So
and
it's okay.
And it says it's a journey. Right, like our anti-racism commitment doesn't say like we are done, right? Like it says that it's a journey. It says it's a journey for us as an organization, and it's a journey for us as individuals within that organization. Because all we are people, right? Like we're humans that are at various stages of our own development and understanding of these things. But to that extent, right, like Noble has to function as a place that serves its children and its teachers and its staff, et cetera. And so when we make these changes, right now we're in a place of like, all right, what has worked for our people? And we made these changes. We came back post-pandemic, which brought its own set.
Post-pandemic?
You're right. That's a good point. We came back post-remote. Post-remote in education. And that brought its own set of challenges and turmoil, which may or may not have been accounted for in our original processes as we were considering, like, what does it mean to come back in an anti-racist way? And so now we have these two things that kind of like reconcile once we get back in these buildings, and we aren't quite sure like what belongs to what, like what challenge belongs exactly to what place. And now that we have like gone through a year of that, we have a more clear vision. Like our students are more adaptable at being back in schools. Our adults are more adaptable at like coming back into like these spaces. We're not quite all the way back yet. I mean, you know, it takes some time. But like we are getting better at it. So now we can actually see what these things look like when we actually stay the course and like stick to the things that we have said we will like lay out and actually do. And so right now that's where we are. It's like, all right, so now that the turmoil of coming back like post-remote, what is the things that we have said we were going to do? How do we stick to that? And what impact does this have on our communities and our people?
I want to add to that, if that's okay, Nick.
No,
I think in addition to what Dee is saying, I think where we are now is a place of, to be quite frank, humility. Mm-hmm. Probably if Noble was a person, I would say that Noble was probably definitely at one of its most humble stages of its life. And I think that's the right place. I think it comes with maturity, mm-hmm. right? Like sometimes when you like win early, you kind of get a little proud and a little pompous and think that you like win at everything. And then it takes you to really be hit with some challenges that you were underprepared for. And I think despite our greatest aspirations, we were still underprepared mm-hmm. for actualizing what we had envisioned. And I think that's just the hard truth of it. And I think the pandemic made that exponentially harder. But I would say today, I think we're in a place of being willing to learn from our own lessons. And that is, I think, a core part of our process, you know, about being reflective and being humble individually. But then what does it mean to be humble and reflective at an organizational level, as an institution? How is the institution reflective and humble? And I would say that that's where we are. We are learning from the things that went well last year and trying to figure out how do we reinforce those things? Mm-hmm. How do we allocate the proper resources to those things? Because we didn't restructure our resources in the way that we needed to, given what we were trying to go after. And that caused a lot of harm and a lot of damage in places. I think we were learning that. I also think we're learning about places in which we need to get better or we were wrong. Mm-hmm. And like, you just didn't do that right. Don't mm-hmm. do that no more.
Right. I'm going to ask, because you're talking and using some...
So that's where we are.
Some like wide range language.
You're
going
to ask us to get specific?
We got to get specific for the people.
Yeah.
You talked about some challenges, some barriers, some lessons learned, yeah. some mistakes that we made.
Mistakes. Yeah.
Let's share some.
So I think I was just talking about this with the principal last week while visiting the school. But I'll say there's a place where, like, when we are revisiting policies or rewriting policies for students or for staff, but particularly for students, that, like, we always want to do, and I think we have really good intentions in our process around how do we build a new dress code. That honors our children, their creativity, their individuality, that isn't restrictive or punitive in what that we enforce it, while also still honoring what our parents wanted, let's say around like safety, mm-hmm. easy recognition, those kinds of things. And I think that like where a place that we went to was we had a lot of choices for students, which like who would say choices for students is a bad thing? It's not. It's the right thing mm-hmm. to do. But I think one of the mistakes that we made is that we didn't couple choice for students with simplicity for adults. Because I think, I'll even say it for me personally, I'll speak for myself, right? I was so inspired, or maybe not inspired is the right word, I was so concerned with making sure that we center our student experience mm-hmm. in that, that it felt like we were almost like, not honoring them if we didn't give them the choices. But like what we didn't consider is that if things are also difficult for implementation or application for the adult, it doesn't matter what the policy is. If it's not simple, if it's not clear, we will still negatively impact the student experience. And so we've had to make changes with our dress code where there's less choices. But the fewer choices has actually now taken uniforms off of people's brains, and we could talk about other things mm-hmm. and we could do other things. And yet our students still have choices.
They do.
They still are dressed like teenagers mm-hmm. in a school, and yet our adults aren't burdened with trying to enforce the right dress code because there are so many choices. And so I would say that like that was that's a learning for us, a lesson for us, about making sure that there are some times where we need to couple decisions with not just in theory, what are we trying to go after, but in practice, what are we trying to get after, and whose experiences matter, and whose experiences matter the most. And I would argue we learn that when it comes to like student dress code, yes, the student's experience matters the most, but we cannot forget the parent or the teacher experience mm-hmm. too. Because they actually need to go hand in hand to truly enhance the student experience in the end. But that's a lesson that we had to learn. And I don't know that we would have known that. I know we wouldn't. Who would have known that a year ago remote when no one was wearing a uniform?
Well, did that lesson change our process this past spring when we went to go and check, look at our policies and look at things that we need to refine a change? Did that lesson, how we arrived at that dress code, change the process we went through to arrive to our current dress code this year?
I mean, I wouldn't have changed the process. I think we could have interrogated more, which I think is what we probably did in our second round, is interrogate the application more. And I think that did happen. And to be honest, I didn't even think it was a huge deal until you look at it today, you know, a year later, and we're looking at a more simplified dress code. Mm-hmm. And it's like you can almost see the positive impact almost immediately within the school space.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I think it still honors what our parents wanted in the first place, which was a dress code that their students, that their students were easily recognizable, for example, as a student that belonged to Noble. Yeah. So I don't know if it changed it, but I would argue that it's a component that we deeply considered when we did last spring's process. That I think we need to continue about, not just in theory, what are we going after, but in practice, what do we need to be true? Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, the way that we know a policy is racist is by the outcomes of it. And so if we're committed to that, though, like in real life, then that means that we have to, one, have a way to measure the outcomes. And then, two, we have to be committed to then responding to what the outcomes say.
You actually a great lead into my next question, which would be about how are we measuring our progress, how are we measuring those outcomes to know what we should even be looking to refine or to adjust for upcoming school years or just in the moment if we need to.
You want me to take that one? You got it.
You know, I can start if you want to pick up at some point. Okay. Noble has always been an organization that measures what matters. It was one of the first things that I heard when I joined 13 years ago, and I still hear it to this day. And so, like, there are some practical and tangible outcomes that we can and do look at. If we consider, like, what is happening with our students and their experience, right, like the student experience survey, we look at that in a way that tells us, like, who is having an experience that is not worthy of what we have hoped to accomplish at Noble. If we look at our family experience survey, we look at that at like which of our parents and families and guardians are not having the experience that we would like for them to have at Noble. Same with our staff engagement survey. Same as our partnership with Promise 54, an organization that allows us to navigate how diversity, equity, and inclusion is showing up at each of our campuses, as well as Noble broadly. Mm-hmm. And so all of these data points allow us to measure like what's happening with regard to experience. But then we're also a data-driven organization in terms of our six commitments. Who's coming to school and who's not every day? And is that a part of like the community that we're creating? Who's getting exclusionary, you know, discipline? Mm-hmm. And is that part of the experience that we're creating? And so like all of the, whose GPA, right. You know, is being dragged behind? And is that part of the what we're teaching and how we're creating in those spaces? And so all of those data points are important, are things that are monitored on our end as well as like multiple other teams. But to that extent, racism isn't always, you know, data. Mm-hmm. It's not always like the number. And so like, it's important for us to figure out like, Jennifer and I also like to create space for folks to say, like, this may not show up in a data point, but I need you to know this is happening in my space. And I want to problem solve around it because I don't think it's right. I don't think it's just, and I don't think it's equitable.
Is that space another survey or that in-person space? Is it inclusive? What kind of space are we?
People talk to us. All the time. Like,
there's not a hallway that we walk down.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, we are grateful to have the time and space to like be on campuses and folks, thanks to things like this, know our faces and, and will pull us aside and talk to us. And we also have, you know, our emails are very public knowledge and people will absolutely email us. We also have an equity team at nobleschools.org email and people reach out to that email address. And so, like, we tell people, like, we are a function only as good as, like, how you all are having an experience with regards to equity and justice in your space. So let us know what's going on. And we try to make ourselves very available for that. We always make space for it.
So in our conversation, we've talked about our process. We talked about some barriers and challenges that we've come through. Mm-hmm. And now we're in a moment now where it's super important that we take those lessons and we apply them. Mm-hmm. Why is it so urgent that we take care of that business right now?
Yeah.
Today.
So if you want to be completely honest, I think that our ARC work is actually more critical that we get it right this year, right now at this moment, than even 2 years ago for a couple of reasons. One, it's like, you know, in 2020, everybody was all down for being anti-racist, for centering DEI, for having DEI statements, affinity spaces, affinity groups, hiring and creating chief equity officers and teams, all the things, not only in education, right, but across nonprofits, across private, the private sector. And that's all well and good. And what I think is critical is that we do not allow our country, our city, our state, or our schools to go back to regular business. And so if we are not vigilant about it, we will see what I consider and what, you know, historians would call like a political backlash. And we will be in a worse place 5 years from now than we are today or than we were 10 years before. Because we cannot let justice be thematic or just be sexy. It is not a fad. It has to be the way in which we run and build our cities and schools. So either it's now or we never really meant it to begin with. I also would say, you know, I think sometimes we forget, you know, here at Noble, like, we have a very big brand and big story and a big district. And we have a lot of schools, charter, public schools, traditional schools, private schools, that look at us and have built their schools off of parts of our model. And I would argue that we owe them to get it right. Because we have people who have, there is like a proliferation almost of a lot of the work that we have done across this country and other schools, which I don't think is anything wrong with that. But if we don't also share what we've learned and how we are evolving and changing, and then get that right so that we can continue to be the model, that's not only a disservice to the 12,000 kids we serve here in Chicago, but that's then a disservice to the hundreds of thousands of kids that are in all those other schools that we'll never touch, we'll never see. And I am almost certain that those kids are Black and brown. And so we don't get to, like, say we made a mistake. We don't get to say it's too hard. We don't get to say, oh, we're going to run out of COVID money or our enrollment is dropping and we don't have the same budget that we used to have, which probably every school system across this country is getting ready to face. But we don't get to say that because of all these things, whether it's teacher shortage or budget changes and shifts, that we can no longer afford to go after justice and freedom in our schools. Mm-hmm. Because as far as I'm concerned, as long as Black and brown bodies are not having the same access to health, to wealth, to education, I don't see how we afford not to. And I would argue that we're kind of in a critical space right now at Noble where either we get it right now or we're never, ever going to actually catch our footing to get it right, period. So we kind of got to do it, and we got to do it now. I would argue that, like, the places that I find so much inspiration is to see how our people came back into our schools this year with their sleeves rolled up, ready to do the work. And I know that last year was historically tough for probably every single body, person, student, staff member, family member that touched Noble. It just was an unusually historically hard year. But to see, you know, thousands of staff members and thousands of parents choose Noble again, because it's a choice. every single day, every single year. But to see our families and our staff members choose Noble again, that's the hope that I have, because that means that people believe in the mission and the vision and the commitments we're trying to go after. But we don't get to just have vision and mission and hopes and dreams. We have to have plans. We have to have strategies. We have to have systems and approaches and frameworks. We have to have models to get it right. And, you know, we won't be perfect at it, but no one's asking for us to be perfect at building anti-racist schools. But we don't get to not be excellent because we're not perfect. That just can't be the choice. So it's now, right now, in this moment, we got to figure it out. And I'm just not interested in the other barriers being a reason why we can't still commit to anti-racism. The other barriers are there. But if we can figure out how to send kids to college better than almost anyone else in the country, I think we can figure this out too. It's just a matter of if we want to.
That was a big, big, big urgent call, call to action. How are we taking this call to action and creating initiatives and supporting help and systems within our organization to help us actualize the anti-racist commitment and that urgency for now?
Yeah, I think first we need to be really clear about what our priorities are. And then once we know what our priorities are, almost time bound them, right? So like what's important right now and then what's important soon and then what's important a little later. And then really sit down and make sure that we are pooling together the proper resources to support those priorities. And I do think we'll have to make some really tough calls and some really tough decisions because unfortunately, you know, we don't have models ourselves. You know, we're almost creating this as we go. Not almost. We are.
We're creating
the plane oftentimes while we're flying it. But I do think that the way to make that plane ride a little smoother is to constantly be reflective on the lesson that we've already learned. But like in real practice, we got to know what our priorities are. Before the pandemic hit in 2019 and 2020, our CEO charged our network to really go after recommendations for our Black boy experience at Noble. Why? Because our data told us that they had the most disparate experience of any subpopulation of students. And I think that it is only fair, it's only just, it's only righteous to then do the work that we said we were going to do because we named it as a priority. And even though that was 2 years ago and the pandemic, of course, you know, caught us all off guard and put us on our heels, our data would tell us that our Black boy experience isn't any better. And so we have work to do. We have work to do. I think thinking about the way we go around diverse staffing and hiring, thinking about who gets to lead our schools, I 100% believe that the people who are in front of our kids have to also look like our kids. The people who run our schools, who are principaling our schools, who are sitting as deans of instruction, and not just deans of culture, but the people who get to make educational decisions on behalf of our children, some of them need to look like them. Some of them have to have shared experiences that our kids have. And I would argue a strategy that we need to really think about and adapt is how do we then create the proper pipelines where we are developing and keeping our people so that way we have that resource. So I do think there are some strategies in practice that we got to get to. The last thing I'll say is, you know, we kind of like joked earlier about the pandemic not being over because it's not. We're still in it. But in all seriousness, we still have tons of trauma and social and emotional needs that our kids are bringing through the door every single day. And we now have national data and statewide data that tells us just how traumatic the pandemic has been, particularly on the people that we serve. You know, yes, we all experienced the pandemic, but we didn't all experience the pandemic equally. And that's just the facts. And the students that Noble serves, there is deeper trauma and a deeper level of crisis that our babies are bringing, you know, into the doors, into our schools. And so I think another priority that we need to get serious about is how do we not only go after the academic needs, because we must, but then how do we also go after the social and emotional needs of our kids? Because I would argue that that is as integral to our DEI work as college access is.
In season one, we talked, sat down with Terrence Pruitt of Project Restore and Robert Spicer of Restorative Strategies, and we talked about Noble being an anti-racist institution, minus restorative practices, and the group was like, that's impossible. Like, you can't be an anti-racist organization if you're not talking about restorative practices and restoring students to the community. Then one could also say we can't talk about being an anti-racist organization without also centering social emotional learning for the students who we serve. So I'd just like to bring up and talk to a little bit more about why is that important for us to put our resources to make that a priority for our students to get that social emotional learning that they need in order for them to, you know, continue to engage academically and be connected to the community?
I'm gonna answer that. I'll start by naming that if you were to ask several different departments, you'll get several different answers. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to name why SEL is important to the equity team and to us as anti-racist practitioners. I'll start by naming racism is traumatic. Let's start there. Ostracization is traumatic. Isolation is traumatic. Poverty is traumatic. Adverse childhood experiences, we've heard about those in their trauma. Like, these are the things that our children are facing when they come into our buildings. And if we don't create the spaces that actually creates a welcoming environment where they're seen as whole humans, where they're honored in the dignity, the original dignity that they have, the inherent dignity that they already have, then we're dropping the ball and seeing them as something as just an outcome or a product, and that's not who they are. They're whole human beings with like lives outside of this space, and we can not only take that trauma and then compound it when they get in this building, we also have to take that trauma, understand that trauma, and lessen that trauma to the greatest of our ability. That's our responsibility. And the truth of the matter is, as anti-racist practitioners, Black and brown children in America have less than. There is a design that leaves most of the children that we serve at Noble with less than their counterparts, which is why Noble exists in the first place. Mm-hmm. It was why it was created, because it recognized that that system is real and that our students don't get the opportunities that they should actually be getting. And if we don't take the opportunity to apply what we know about social and emotional learning and the amount of trauma that takes place outside of our buildings, not just that, but also potentially inside our buildings, mm-hmm. and look at our children as whole humans that we have to nurture and water and like pour into, then we are doing a disservice to our children. Because it's not just about their product or their output or their college matriculation or their GPA when they graduate. Like, that's not the end goal. The end goal is for them to be the humans that they were inherently born to be, and for that value to be exponentially generated once they walk through our doors.
Getting Down to Practice is our part of our podcast, where our audience gets to hear from our guests about practical tips or strategies they can implement in their school or in their district. This is an opportunity for you all to provide that practice to our team. Anything you got for the people?
Yeah, so I would say one of our new initiatives that we are launching this school year is another cohort model called EQ, because we like a good acronym. But the equity quotient, now D gonna have to tell you why quotient, because it's not related to math.
That's it's not related to math.
It's not.
No, quotient is a math concept, but in this particular case, a quotient is the degree to which something is present in the space. And for us, we want the equity quotient to be really high at each of our campuses.
So we know that like DEI work cannot live with just two people. Mm-hmm. It cannot live with us. It has to be something that all of our leaders and all of our staff members are committed to. And we believe that to be so, but commitment alone isn't enough. we also have to have skills. And so what the EQ is designed to do is to share and build DEI competencies and skills in our leaders across the organization. And so we are asking for sitting members of the leadership teams, at least one per campus. And we're also opening it up to our Noble support team for our leaders to apply to be a part of a cohort where we are specifically giving leadership skills around DEI and anti-racism in an effort for those leaders to then go out and help carry the work, do the work, carry the load on their shoulders, and so then lead DEI learning spaces in their own schools, on their own teams, also to serve as consultants and thought partners and problem solvers of really difficult and sometimes intricate DEI puzzles that do arise in our spaces. And so Dee and I love being partners with our campuses and our NST team, but we are not trying to hoard any skills. Mm-hmm. That's actually the opposite of what it means to be committed to anti-racism, right? It's about making sure that all of us have the skills needed to be able to really realize our commitment to anti-racism. And so that's what the EQ is about. It's about building those skills for all our leaders so that all of our leaders can do all of the work.
Jennifer, Dee, thanks for joining Changing the Course Season 2. Stay in the course. All right?
That's right.
Before we leave, we want you all to read our founding quote by Bettina Love.
To love all children, we must struggle together to create the schools we are taught to believe are impossible.
Schools built on justice, love, joy, and anti-racism.
Thanks for joining Changing the Course.
Changing the Course is a video podcast series produced by Noble Schools, a leading public charter school network in Chicago, Illinois. If you're interested in seeing the video for this episode or learning more about Noble, you can visit us at nobleschools.org. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Changing the Course is hosted by Nicholas Jones, Assistant Director of Student Support and Culture at Noble Schools. This episode was produced by Janelle Jones, Nicholas Jones, and Ash Kenyon, and it was edited by Ash Kenyon. The music you heard throughout this episode was created by Angel Mancia, one of our students at Mission College Prep. It was mixed and edited by David Reddick, a music teacher at Mission. If you have any questions you would like us to answer during this series, send us an email at communications@nobleschools.org with the subject line, Question for Changing the Course. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.